If you had the choice to live forever, would you do so? My guest today is Zoltan Isfahan, and he's a futurist, author, and entrepreneur. Zoltan began his career as a National Geographic journalist and was in a lot of war zones during his time as a journalist. After all the death he witnessed and also a near-death experience where he almost tripped on a landmine in Vietnam, he decided to dedicate himself to stopping death. That is, to stop death for himself and for his loved ones. This is what sparked his interest in transhumanism, where he is now one of the global leaders of the movement. So what is transhumanism? Transhumanism is a social and psychological movement in which the proponents advocate and predict the enhancement of the human condition by developing technologies that are able to greatly enhance longevity, mood, and cognitive abilities. The movement has many goals, but the primary goal is to overcome biological death. Most people have probably never thought about the possibility of immortality, but science and technology are showing a lot of potential with this actually being possible in the near future. However, is it ethical and moral to live forever? And what will it mean to be human if we are to become more than human? So Zoltan was a 2016 US presidential candidate for the Transhumanist Party, and he is also the author of The Transhumanist Wager. So you are listening to the Inventing the Future podcast, where we tell the stories of the visionary tech entrepreneurs that are solving the world's biggest problems. This is Julian Alvarez, and I'm a Gen Z entrepreneur and a software engineer at Facebook. Now with that, let's go ahead and dive into this thought-provoking conversation on the future. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode. I have an awesome guest with me today. His name is Zoltan. So yeah, Zoltan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I think to get started, you have a big history on a lot of things you've done, but I'm curious in your words, if you could briefly tell us a bit about yourself and your story and how you got to where you are today in this entrepreneurial realm and leading the movement as a transhumanist.
Sure. Well, I began my transhumanism, I guess, trajectory by having kind of a near-death experience with a landmine in Vietnam when I was working in National Geographic. Now, as a result of that, and we'll get in a little bit later what transhumanism is, but briefly, it's just a social movement trying to use science and technology to improve the human being and also to improve the human experience. But number one goal really is trying to overcome death. And so this experience working for National Geographic and some of the dangerous things I saw, including the landmine, really kind of got me down a path of trying to be a part of this movement. So I wrote a novel. I ran for the presidency for the Transhumanist Party. I was a journalist for many years regarding transhumanism. So I've been doing a lot of different things like that, but basically a media figure working towards publicizing what transhumanism is about and trying to get people interested in it. It's a movement that needs money in order to move forward because it's all about research.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. There's nothing like a near-death experience that can change your entire perspective and therefore direction in life. The perspective of death will do that. And interestingly, now you're trying to completely avoid that outcome. So yeah, tell us a little more about transhumanism, what it is, why it's important, and why you're so interested in it.
Sure. Well, I think most people know transhumanism as just this radical technology being applied to human beings like brain implants or even driverless cars or jetpacks or whatever crazy technology it is that makes us kind of more than human. But I think a lot of people overlook the fact that transhumanism is also a social movement. It's a lifestyle. People want to get off planet. People want to travel through space. People don't want to be in the flesh like myself. I think the flesh is terminal, and I would prefer to merge with machines, be a lot smarter, have an IQ, maybe of a million or something like that, and be part artificial intelligence and things like that. So that's really what it's about. It's kind of this dream, a bit science fiction-y still, but it's every day it's getting closer with Silicon Valley leading the forefront. One day we are going to surpass our biology and become cyborgs and probably just pure data at some point, you know, in the next 100, 200, 300 years.
Yeah, I've heard the phrase say that if you can't beat them when it comes to like machines and the intelligence that they'll acquire, then we'll basically have to become them in a way, right? You see that as the only outcome in the future?
Definitely the only outcome. Probably if machines will retain a sense of their humanity, so they might always be nice to the humans that remain human, because certainly a huge section of the population will probably not want to become machines. But that said, if you really want to prosper, if you want to make business, I mean, it's like trying not to use a cell phone or the internet and trying to be successful in business these days. It's just kind of impossible. And the same thing's going to happen with human experience. If you don't take on the most radical technologies that are out there, you're going to be left behind. That might be your style, but it may not be very interesting compared to what other people are doing. You know, one of the things where they're trying to do is they're trying to work on these exoskeleton suits that you can put on, you can run across a lake. So now they'll have marathons across the lake. That'll be a new, maybe Olympic sporting event, because these exoskeleton suits allow you to run so fast that you can run on water. If you run 78 miles per hour, you can run on water. That's about what the scientists say. But these are the kinds of things that people will want to do. And it sounds really cool to me to be able to run across a lake or run across the ocean. And I think those that choose not to do it may be missing out on something really interesting.
Absolutely. One really interesting thing I found in my research is that you said that when it comes to humans and our perceptions, we're only able to perceive like 1% of the light in the whole light spectrum of the universe. And we're only able to hear less than 1% of all the sounds that can be heard in the universe. So our perceptions, even though we feel like we have a conception of the universe and everything around us, is actually extremely limited. And so then there's a big question around how might our human experience change if we're able to increase that, even double it. But imagine if we were able to get to, I don't know, closer to 100%. What do you think that would look like?
Well, I think this is when intelligence and experience is very limited right now. We have an anthropological framework. We think of things in terms of how we experience it as a human being. And that means we have 3 pounds of meat in our heads, and that's the brain, and that's how it focuses, and we have our 5 senses. But, you know, I mean, merging with a machine intelligence that has the computational power that's maybe already a million times us, and maybe has servers that fill up the Empire State Building in terms of what's possible. I mean, our entire experience, we could have 100 senses. We're going to see so many different things. We're going to see all these different lights and all the hear all these different things. I mean, it could be revolutionary. And I think when we talk about human experience, and yes, some people really passionate, they get out and they're great artists or whatever, but just imagine the kind of art that's going to be created once you've actually tapped into that other 99%. I mean, let's say painting is a visual experience. Imagine that you're only experiencing 1% of the light spectrum right now of what's out there. I mean, people could do a lot more interesting things if we were just even to get 20-30% more. And we have the tools. So we have a lot of the robotics out there can already see 60-70% of what's out there in the universe. There's some dark matter, so we can't see all of it yet. But the point is that once we tie that into our brain, we'll be able to relate it directly into our consciousness. And that could be a very different experience of what it means to be a human being.
Yeah, no, I mean, we'd have to redefine what being human means, but that's fascinating. Yeah, so I'm curious, how would you describe the problems that transhumanism is aiming to solve? You obviously talked about death. And for example, I researched and found that 55 million people die every year. And even for those that are still old and alive, many of them don't really have a good quality of life. So I'm curious if you could speak more to the magnitude and the breadth of the problem that exists here.
Sure, sure. And maybe a figure that's a little bit easier for your listeners to hear is it's about 150,000 a day. And you know, if you want to break that down by hour, what is that, 10,000 hour or even more or less a little bit. But the point is that it's a huge number of people that are dying. These are people that have loved ones, these are families. And so overcoming death is the number one goal of transhumanism. But I want to point out that like transhumanism is already doing some major real life day-to-day things. Like if you're a soldier in Afghanistan, you get your leg blown off by a landmine or shot off or something like that. We now have prosthetics that are tied to your neural system that will allow you to put on a robotic arm and still be able to play the piano, still be able to grab a beer and drink it. And these robotic prosthetics that are tied to your brain get better every day. So you can think, I'm going to grab that beer, and then it works. So we're already, the transhumanist scientists are already implementing these things. It's probably only a year or 2 years away when biohackers will probably cut off electively limbs to put on these robotic ones. Mm-hmm. It may not be just time yet. They might do it just for show, but within 5 to 10 years, there's a good chance that some robotic limbs will be more functional in some ways than the human arm is. And at some point in the future, when you talk about like football, you're going to throw a football a half a mile with perfect precision. So who's not going to want to use those things? But right now, a lot of these innovations are being used on wounded veterans and the handicapped and disabled people. Disabled people are especially very connected to transhumanism because it's the technology that's giving them their lives and their strength and the things that they may need to live more fully.
Well, yeah. So right now it's mainly benefiting those that have the greatest necessity, but in the near future, it's just going to be an augment of our current human capabilities. And that's when it becomes much more attractive to the entire world. Right. I'm curious how you would see the disparity, the economic disparity that might exist, given that these technologies might be expensive. Like what happens in the future if only a small portion of people have access to these technologies? And we already have great income inequality and the smart people are just going to get smarter and there's going to be this huge gap. What do you see as a way to deal with a problem like that?
Well, I mean, in my book, the number one problem right now, really in the social sphere is inequality, and it's gotten worse during COVID. There's no question about it. I'm a big supporter of a universal basic income, and I have been for now, I guess, 7-8 years from my very first presidential campaign in 2016. So I do think that a basic income could at least put a floor so that people don't starve to death and have housing. We don't have this giant homeless problem and whatnot. And I think that would be a good start for helping inequality. It doesn't mean equality actually happens, but at least it means nobody's on the streets. You know, if they're on the streets, then it's mental issues and stuff like that. It's not a result of, I just don't have the money in my pocket. At least then we could solve that issue. So that would be one thing I do. But I think beyond that, if you had a properly structured basic income, you'd probably have access to healthcare systems that would say, well, look, we want to augment you. We want to make you stronger. And I think most people have a real vested interest in participating in society. And the more augmented we become, the more people are going to kind of want to work or do challenges and new art and new buildings. What I mean, who knows, new sports. And the point is that the more opportunity you have through transhumanism, the more you're going to want to live and embrace those things. So we need a system that would kind of allow people to get access to all those things, whether it's rich or poor. And it starts with a basic income, in my opinion, especially with automation at some point going to be taking jobs away too.
Definitely. Yeah. No, I think universal basic income is going to become more of a essential necessity. I'm pretty optimistic in my perspective. The way I would see it is that if richer people or people that have more money are able to afford these technologies, then you would hope that what they do with that in the way that they augment their capabilities and intelligence, it helps develop solutions, technologies, and whatnot that are able to elevate those that are at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I think it's fine for that gap to exist initially, but I think it also gives a greater responsibility for those at the top and that have those capabilities to help those that don't. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think despite the bad name that a lot of billionaires get, I do think most billionaires, especially the technology ones, are interested in general welfare. I mean, if you look at historically, the guys who started the banks, the robber barons, these are people who really didn't care about the poor. But there's a lot of people out there, whether it's Jeff Bezos, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg, they may have some bad rap, but these are billionaires giving billions of dollars to doing things. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg gave $3 billion to try to overcome all disease in his lifetime. I mean, Jeff Bezos gave $10 billion to helping the environment. People give these guys a bad name, but they're doing something very solid, something much more than I could ever do to help the world out. So I do have more confidence than most people in the super wealthy helping out, especially the super wealthy in technology, helping out the broader face of humanity.
Well, yeah, Mark Zuckerberg is currently my boss and I honestly respect him and I don't think he deserves a lot of the bad rep, but that's a whole conversation that we'll dodge for now. I want to bring up an objection here because many people might say that the fact that we're going to die is what enriches life, right? I mean, part of what makes life so precious is the scarcity of time that we have in this life. And like, for example, why would I care about focusing on getting things done today if I know that there's always going to be tomorrow?
So I hear this argument a lot, and honestly, it's a very good argument. However, there's a piece of this argument that a lot of people don't realize. If you look at it from a purely human perspective, like the 3 pounds of meat back to your what your brain weighs, then yes, the limited amount of time does add value. but we're not going to stay human. We're going to discover that 99% other part of the universe that we have no idea about. In fact, our intelligence might grow by a millionfold in the next 1,000 years. And when you talk about what else we can experience, it's almost a death to not experience that because there's so much going to be out there. Again, our experience right now is so limited. So one of the reasons I say there is value in pursuing indefinite lifespans is not because I disagree with your argument. It's because there's another side of that argument. And the argument is that the complexity of life, of creativity, of discovering what else is out there and improving our own intellect is what makes us push on pursuit for the indefinite lifespan. It's not because we don't value it because they're limited. That's a good argument. It's because we also see that we're going to become something so amazing and we don't want to miss out on that.
I completely agree. I think one of the most beautiful things in life is to be able to discover what you're capable of creating, giving, becoming, and achieving in this life. And if your life is cut short, then so is that potential. And that does scare me. And I think a related problem here that you've talked about is that 80% of people don't care about dying because they believe in an afterlife. And you also cited that, I don't know if this is still true, but all 535 members of the US Congress believe in an afterlife, and so does the president. So it's like, how are we going to get them, these people with the power, to actually invest in this sort of idea and movement and technology? And I guess the broader question there is, how do you go about changing the culture of a country and of the world, given the context of these problems and people's mindsets?
That is, in my opinion, one of the most fundamental problems. Like, transhumanists believe that aging is a disease. We don't want to see our parents die. We don't want to see our children die. We don't want to see anyone die if they don't want to. Now, of course, if people want to die, that's up to them. But we would like everybody to have that personal choice. And when you have all members of Congress, all members of the Supreme Court, you know, vice president, president, everybody saying they believe in an afterlife, and I'm not sure if it's still 535 members, but whatever it is, it's 99% overwhelmingly believe in either Jesus or some kind of other heaven after this. And therefore, it's correct to want to die. And I understand that argument. But for those of us who don't believe in that, or at least I don't really know, I think the best thing is to make a transhumanist wager, is what we call it, where you decide to dedicate all your resources and your time and energy into overcoming death. Now, later down the road, we can all decide we want to die. But we at least want to get out that choice. And I think if we could convince Congress and other members of, you know, the top members of society, especially those in politics, to step outside their window of religion and the afterlife, we could probably conquer death in 10 or 20 years. It would probably just take $1 trillion. But right now, the NIH, is like National Institute of Health, is really not even funding. It doesn't consider aging a terminal disease. And if, as long as it doesn't consider aging a disease or dying a problem, then it's never going to spend any money on it. Yes, it's spending money on trying to make it so you, if you have cancer, you can overcome it and maybe die a more normal death. But that's not the same thing as what we're talking about. It's like COVID. We're talking about vaccines. We're talking about eliminating COVID from the planet forever. That's how transhumanists think. And we want to eliminate all diseases as well as have the choice to whether age or not.
That's fascinating. And one thing I'm curious about is that, where does this thinking come from you? Because it's very contrarian, right? Like, as we already mentioned, most people don't believe these things. So have you, for example, done things like psychedelics? And if so, how have they influenced the way you think? Like, how'd you get to these conclusions yourself?
Well, I think one of the first things is, going back to psychedelics in a little bit, I worked as a journalist in National Geographic, and I covered a lot of conflict zones. So I've seen some heavy things, a bit of fighting and that kind of stuff. And just, you see a little bit of death and some torture victims and whatnot. You realize all of a sudden, wow, the real world is very heavy and sketchy, and we need to solve these problems. And it's not just a problem of solving it in society. It's a problem of solving death. I mean, war wouldn't be such a big deal like they are in video games, because when you die, it's not really death. We could make the same thing here in the real world, where maybe you could get super badly hurt, but you just reconstitute in a way that all of a sudden you're back. People don't have to die from bullet wounds. There are, you know, in 100 years, we're going to look back and say, wow, it's amazing people died from bullet wounds. Why didn't we figure that out sooner? But the point is that we can overcome all these things. And I went through a lot of these experiences as a journalist, seeing some heavy stuff. And it really just kind of propelled me forward to say, I got to tackle death as the number one priority in my life. But that said, I had other experiences. Before on the show, we discussed a little bit of whether I had done some psychedelics. And yes, I have. And I got to say, they're very important. LSD. I did mushrooms in Costa Rica, but LSD I did in the United States, and one day did a few weeks of it in a row. I mean, I'm in San Francisco, so this is a bit of a pilgrimage. It's just simply what you do if you grow up in this area. And these things were very important to me. It's not the drugs that are important. You have to understand. It's the idea that I wanted to step outside my comfort zone and see something different. And that's really what transhumanism is about. If you wanted to put one word about transhumanism down, I'd say it's curiosity. We are curious to find out how far the body can go. If I can have a third arm, I wouldn't mind trying that. If I can have an IQ five times mine connected to a computer, I want to have that. So we're curiosity addicts, and I think we want to go further with those kinds of things.
That is the core of an entrepreneur, never sticking to the status quo and always, no matter how good things are or how bad they are, it's about seeing things for what they could be and not for what they currently are. So I love that. Zoltan, so you write about these very controversial topics, and obviously you get a lot of backlash and whatnot. So I'm curious, how do you deal with the psychological toll of receiving so much criticism?
Yeah. No, I mean, I get pegged as the Antichrist quite a lot because in a real way, from a religious perspective, we are trying to recreate ourselves almost as godlike creatures and overcome death, replacing any of the need for those higher powers. But it's not like that. We care just as much about people. We care just as much about humanity and trying to help one another, maybe even more so. And but the point is that, you know, there is a lot of criticism. Some of my New York Times articles just get bashed and endlessly for days on end. But it's just part of the terrain. I mean, you had spoken like even earlier with about your boss, Mark Zuckerberg, getting a bad rap. I have a bad rap myself. I don't believe it's deserved. I'm a nice family man. I got two beautiful girls. I'm a good father. But when you're talking about something so wild as transhumanism, overcoming the human body, taking off an arm and putting on a robotic arm, then all of a sudden people really freak out. And that's a natural result. And I think when you lead something forward that is unknown, especially as an entrepreneur or as an idea, you can always expect a more severe backlash than anything else you might be doing because it's unknown territory and people are afraid.
Yeah, no, that reminds me of one of Peter Diamandis' favorite quotes where he says that the day before something, it's a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea. So this is kind of like this period where it's like, what? This is insane. But everything is like that at the beginning until it becomes the norm, like Airbnb and things like that. So I love it. All right. So on the topic of entrepreneurship, I'm curious how these transhumanism philosophies and ideas, how have they impacted or influenced the way that you've acted as an entrepreneur and the things you've done as a businessman?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because I have had a number of businesses, but none of them have been related to transhumanism. Actually, I had the luck of starting a real estate development company early in my 20s that did very well during the boom years, and I sold the majority of it. And it's allowed me to not have to work yet, at least not have to work physically for a boss or something like that. I mean, I still have my investments or whatever. And as a result, as a journalist, I was not really working because I needed the money anymore. I was just kind of like, it was National Geographic. You could do this stuff for free if you probably could. But the point is that I ended up having this real estate business that sold and allowed me for many years and still to do whatever I sort of wanted. And I have dedicated all that time, all that energy to promoting transhumanism because for me, it's a race against death. Now, maybe you're a little bit younger, you're 20 years younger, you'll probably almost certainly, unless you get cancer or die in a terrible car accident or something, you almost certainly make it to have the choice of an indefinite lifespan because we're only 10, 20 years away from the different types of technologies that will overcome death. But I'm almost at age 50 and too close. My father died at 73, so I have maybe 25 years left. We better figure out how to overcome death now or I missed the boat. What a big bummer. So I am on a daily basis fighting for this concept. Let me just give your listeners and yourself a statistic. If we can cure death by the year 2030 versus the year 2050, we will be able to save 1 billion lives. That's 1 billion lives. So transhumanists believe they're in a race to overcome death. It's not just a race to, you know, because we think it's super cool. It's because every single day, 150,000 people die. So every day that we make a little bit closer to it, and one day we beat it out by 3 or 4 years, wow, we're saving 150 million lives. So I feel very strongly that I take my time and the money that I made from selling my company to essentially spending it and using it so that I can just work full time at transhumanism. Unfortunately, I don't make any money in this arena because you don't make money as a journalist. You don't make money doing interviews and whatever, but I am making value in terms of the more people that hear about it, the more money goes to the researchers, the quicker we can get to a point where we can overcome death. I believe every day that I'm saving people's lives. Might not be today, but it will be in 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I love that. No, and I love the initiative and the influence. It kind of reminds me of Elon Musk's philosophy with Tesla, where it's like he doesn't really care who ends up doing electric cars. And if someone else like ends up building a better company, it doesn't matter. His goal is like if Elon was able to accelerate the pace at which we get to electric cars by 10 years, then that's we're already saving the planet by a significant amount. So it's not necessarily who does it or whatnot. It's about getting there as soon as possible because of the impact that that results, not only the short term, but in the magnitude of the long term. Cool. So Zoltan, I know we're almost out of time. I want to ask two quick questions. One is, if you could teach all entrepreneurs one concept related to life or entrepreneurship, what concept would that be?
So I think, to be honest with you, this is a little bit strange, but I was going to say, whoever you choose to partner up with in life, either marry or whatever, it doesn't matter whatever your choice is or who, him, her, she, whatever, it doesn't matter. But whoever it is, almost all of us end up being with someone for long periods of time. Take that as your most important decision, probably more important decision than even the companies that you're involved in. Because if you don't find a partner who allows you to pursue your dreams, you will stagnate and you will get sucked into a vortex that's really more about dishwashers than it is about your passions. And I got lucky. I married a very wonderful woman who's a doctor. She's very neutral on transhumanism. She's not a transhumanist fan at all, but she allows me to pursue it in a way that is, go do what you want to do if you feel like you need to save the world or save humanity. And that's really been very important. I'm not sure some of the girls before her that I dated would have allowed that. I think so. If you have one real big advice, take time that you find someone who is an enabler of your dreams rather than, or at least neutral, rather than somebody who really is going to say, hey, this is our life. We have a baby, blah, blah, blah. You need to focus on the house or focus on work. And then your dreams go to the wayside. I have many friends, older friends, that that has happened to. So that's my big single thing of advice.
Oh, man, that is wise. Thank you for that wisdom. Simple, but powerful. One quick yes or no question. Are we living in a simulation?
Probably. I would say yes, because I think the statistical probability is 50 to 60%. So I'll say yes if I have to give a yes or no. But as a philosophy major, and I did my senior thesis on brains in a vat, this is exactly simulation theory, I would say there's a good chance of it and probably a more likely chance than not.
Amazing. Cool. All right. Final question for you, Zoltan. What impact do you want to have in the invention of the future? How will you invent the future?
Well, for me, I think the biggest impact is because I'm part of the transhumanist movement, but I'm not a scientist, so I'm in a weird state, is not actually trying to invent any specific cure for aging or a robotic arm or prosthetic. What I'm trying to do is to create movements in the actual widespread distribution of transhumanist knowledge. And that's why I run for president. That's why I'm governor. That's why I drive these crazy coffin buses across the country, why I write books, why I do a lot of TV and movie stuff and whatnot. It's because I'm trying to break through in terms of letting people know about it. Because in any movie, take environmentalism, for example, it's not just people that are trying to protect trees. There are accountants, there are lawyers, there are doctors, there are the tree people too. There are the environmentalist scientists. And transhumanism is the very same thing. We have media personalities, we have the doctors, we have the scientists, we have the accountants, we have the lawyers. We have everything across the board, the software engineers, the coders, whatnot. A movement requires everybody. And my job is sort of probably one of the movement's main media personalities is just to convey that transhumanism is not only fun and cool, but it's really life-changing in terms of helping humanity out and making people live a lot longer and not have to lose their family members to death. And if I can convince more people to do that, that's how I will innovate the future. And that's my great goal of it all.
That's brilliant. I've always thought that in order to have influence and impact, it's not just about building products or services or investing. Many times your influence can be magnified through your voice as the thought leader. So I think it's a spectacular way. And I think that's how movement begins and real change begins. So I appreciate what you're doing. And one quick thing I want to mention as something brilliant is that your strategy in running for president, you didn't expect to win, but it's what gathered more attention to the movement. So it's kind of like that play you were having in forming this culture and shifting the culture. So one final thing to mention there. But cool, Zoltan, yeah. I know you're busy. So thank you for your time. I enjoyed having you on.
Sure. And let me just say one more thing to your listeners too, because I didn't mention it. Last year, a documentary called Immortality or Bust came out on my presidential campaign when I drove the giant coffin across the country. It's now on Amazon Prime. It's also on a whole bunch of other places. It's a sort of sad story as I'm driving a coffin bus across the country while my father is dying. So there's this juxtaposition about me trying to conquer death while one of my closest family members is dying. But at the same time, it's a beautiful feature documentary. So if your listeners are interested in it, it's well worth watching for 70, 80 minutes. And it really explores the transhumanist movement because we went across the country to all the different transhumanist groups in America and joined rallies and stuff like that and saw what they were doing. So it's a good road trip movie to discover transhumanists. It's called Immortality or Bust. And the easiest way to watch is on Amazon Prime.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Wow. That is quite the dichotomy between preaching for life, but also being worried about the death of a loved one.
Yeah. It'll make you cry. The movie is very sad because it doesn't end well, of course. And that's the whole thing about transhumanism. It doesn't end well unless we can overcome death. So people that have watched it really liked it.
I think the great thing is that we're empowered more than ever today to be able to work on technologies and things to be able to guarantee a better future. So thank you for contributing to that movement and to a better life for all humanity. So awesome. Thanks again for coming on and I appreciate it. It was fun to talk.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we will catch you on the next episode. Take care and be infinite as always. Hey guys, three quick footnotes here before closing off. So the first is, did you enjoy the topics discussed in this episode? Well, I invite you to join the Slack community for this podcast, where we'll keep the conversation going by engaging in discussions related to the episodes discussed in this podcast. Here, you'll be able to engage in conversations with me and other listeners. And if you really enjoy this podcast, it is likely that you would relate well with other listeners that also enjoy the podcast. In this community, you'll be able to meet, engage, learn from, and potentially collaborate with the like-minded entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast. Let's invent the future together. The second quick note is, if you are interested in receiving updates on new episodes, I invite you to subscribe to my newsletter. And in this newsletter, I'll also share notes, insights, wisdom, tools, and strategies that are designed to help you become a better entrepreneur and live a healthier, fulfilling, and more productive life. And finally, the last footnote is that you can follow us on social media accounts to get updates on new episodes and engage with invaluable content related to entrepreneurship. And also, we have a website now. You can go to inventingthefuture.ai for detailed show notes on all the episodes. So the links for joining the Slack community, subscribing to the newsletter, the social media accounts, and the website can all be found in the show notes for this episode. So with that, I would like to wish you a day, week, year, and life filled with an abundance of love, energy, and prosperity. Take care and stay infinite, my friends.